Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
There was plenty of incident even in those 7.3 overs that we saw so far today. Sheldon Cotterill with 2 wickets. He, of course, is the man of the fine celebration. And talking on Nick Compton's Cricket World Cup show this morning, both Nick and Matt were discussing celebrations and send-offs in cricket following the West Indies' fine, fine moves.
I tell you what, we need to talk about celebrations, don't we? Because we saw, just before the break, Cotterill getting out Amla. He got out his fantastic celebration, the salute, which seems to take about 20 seconds to do or something. It's the longest celebration I've ever seen. Do you like it?
I like it. I mean, geez, he's a strong boy, isn't he? I mean, he gets into that sort of army position and you think, I wouldn't want to come up against him in a war or a battle, would you? I mean, he looks like... I love it. I mean, look, I do love it. I think, you know, there's a fine line between a send-off and a celebration, and where does that sort of come? But I think as long as you're not trying to get into the face of the batsman, your job's done. You've got the batsman out. You've achieved your goal. You know, what happens afterwards? You see Imran Tahir. He goes for about a 4-kilometre run after he gets a wicket. Why you do that when you've got to spend 50 overs out there, I don't know. But I think that's what West Indies bring to this game. And I think more teams should do it, actually. But as you say, as long as it doesn't get in the face of the batsman. And but, you know, I mean, talking about his celebration, I mean, the catch that he took the other day. I mean, that was up there with Stokes's, wasn't it?
You could argue it was better because he had to hold his balance and then throw it back in. He did it so gracefully.
In your club days, though, you must have had a few send-offs, surely.
I used to get loads of send-offs because, you know, I'd come straight from doing Cricket AM on Sky get a first ball duck and would get a send-off. You know, that would generally...
Come on, give us... I can only think what that was like. Give us a few comments. What would it be?
I got some great ones. I got called Charles Colville's Gimp a couple of times. That was a good one. I laughed. And then, you know, often you get out there, like, you know, report on that, mate. Talk us through that one.
You can actually hear the assembled crowds in the control room, in the technical room, giggling with laughter at Charles Colville's Gimp there from Nick Compton's Cricket World Cup show every morning, 10 a.m. You know, I think that chat between sides is one of the best things about cricket. I love it. You know, I play club cricket as regularly as I can on a Saturday, and this season I've had a bit of a running theme of sledges against me, right? So I don't bat with a helmet. Ever since I was hated wearing a helmet as a kid, but you had to until you were 18, and as soon as I could, I took it off and batted in a cap. Now, I believe these days people think it's very ill-advised, and I never really thought much of it until I went out to bat for the first time this season. And before I'd even faced a delivery, the bowler said to me, look, mate, I'm bowling quite quick and the pitch is doing a few funny things. You might want a helmet. I was just like, what? How am I? Are you actually saying that you're dangerous and quick and so I should be wearing a helmet? Anyway, I promptly got out. And the next week, the same thing happened. Even the umpire gave me chat about it. The third week, I got hit on the head. So maybe I am in the wrong. Maybe I'm not seeing the ball well enough. Maybe my reactions aren't good enough. Who knows? I'll tell you whose reactions did have to be good this weekend. It was Lewis Hamilton after Sebastian Vettel came careering across the grass and ended up very nearly colliding with Lewis Hamilton. Let's speak to someone and get a racer's opinion on the penalty he was given. Perry McCarthy, former F1 driver, is on the line now. Perry, this incident, how did you see it live? And then what was your reaction to the penalty?
Too many rules in Formula One. Too many. We want to see spectacular close racing. And, okay, Seb lost it under braking because Lewis had been putting him under so much pressure. He went across the grass. Lots of skill involved in saving that, coming back across the track. Yeah, sure. Lewis tried to take, as one would, you tried to take advantage of that situation. But the Ferrari slid straight across the road. and Lewis had to get out of it fast. This is top-level motor racing. They are both absolutely brilliant drivers, and they're both capable of getting away with what they did. It doesn't need the blimmin' stewards involved. You know, it's killing it for us.
But do you not think, in that specific situation, Lewis was on the racing line, minding his own business, frankly, and had to slam on the brakes to avoid Vettel, who was out of control? Surely he should be given some recompense for that.
Yeah, but what do you want to see? People are always totally in control after you, Claude, after you, sir. It's just, this is supposed to be war at the front end. It's already been sanitized enough with massive runoff areas, halos, hands, everything else. Some of those are obviously very good devices. They really are. But, you know, when we come to the absolute action, less rules, not more. I want to be on the edge of my seat going, wow, that was so close. I mean, if you look back to racing in the past, how these guys used to go about it, there weren't all these rules and regulations. The boys monitored themselves at the end of the day. But that was exciting. I don't really want to be sitting back with stewards controlling how the outcome of a race between two brilliant world championships is run.
What did you make of Vettel's reaction? Obviously, he was on the radio complaining about having the race stolen from him. He moved the demarkers of one and two so that he put a two in front of Hamilton's. It was a little childish, I thought.
But it's emotion. I mean, that's what we want to see, passion. This isn't, you know, sometimes the drivers are accused of being robotic and then now they're accused of being childish. It's sheer passion that gets these cars don't go around the circuit like that on their own.
Mm.
These guys are absolutely on the ragged edge. Their heart is in their mouth an awful lot of the time. They are pushing like mad. And that race between Lewis and Seb yesterday, that was high drama for those two, even though they pretty much streaked off into the distance. Charles was just a little way off. But it was those two, and they were on the absolute ragged edge. So when you're living like that for an hour and a half, you know, you're not robotic. You are passionate and you're emotive. You're emotional about it. And, you know, Seb has every right to be disgruntled, knowing that his race is going to be taken away by the stewards with this 5-second penalty.
I'll tell you something you'll know, Perry, better than me. I'm always amazed when you hear these team radios on the broadcast. Yesterday, Vettel's was quite an extended back and forth, you know, with his garage. I mean, it's not like a hands-free in the car pootling along at 30 miles an hour on the A34. These guys are driving at the limit. I'm amazed that they can talk to their engineers with such passion and sort of quite so much.
Yeah, I mean, the capacity these guys have, mental capacity, not just the physical capacity and also the innate talent that they have, is incredible. You know, they can multifunction.
Mm.
You know, back in my day, it was probably, you know, I could maybe string a few sentences together, but most of the time I was trying to hold on for dear life in the thing I was in. So these guys, you know, between the two of them, they've won 9 world championships. You're dealing with absolute class from both Lewis and from Sebastian. But that's what we want to see. And, you know, honest to God, I was looking at the TV yesterday and shouting at the TV going, no, please don't put this into the steward's office, please. This is, you know, rejoining a circuit, the rule, rejoining the circuit safely. Well, you know, Seb was already kind of out of control. That was probably about 100 miles an hour across the grass at that point as he's coming back on. And he already had the back out, which is why he had to slide sideways, which closed Lewis's gap down. Lewis can see that coming. He tried to think, okay, if Seb did stay left, there's a chance on the outside. But there wasn't. So Lewis slammed brakes on. But that's the same as any other fight. You know, the Formula One doesn't just happen. These boys have come all the way through junior motor racing. If you want to see rough and tough battling, it's look at the junior stuff, because they don't get nailed quite as much as the F1 drivers do. But there should be more continuity with all these penalties. But as a spectator, we want to watch racing, as I keep saying, and I don't want to know about how many rules and penalties there are all the time. Because, you know, we don't want to lose viewers on this. We want people glued to it, edge of their seat for action.
Mm. Well, we could argue about this all day, but I also want to ask you about Lewis himself, because he equaled a Schumacher record the weekend,
seven.
Canadian Grand Prix. You know, Hamilton set a lot of records in his career, and the names, you know, he was very emotional. I remember at Canada equaling Ayrton Senna's pole records, and very emotional about that. He's now starting to catch up with Schumi's records. Where do you think Lewis is in terms of being close to or level with Schumacher, if we have to sort of say who is the best of all time?
I mean, the best of all time is an argument that could rage between whoever you're speaking to, because you'd have to throw Alain Prost out in Senna, Michael Schumacher, as you said, maybe Nicky into the mix. Lewis absolutely is in the mix. And, you know, Sebastian, I'm not completely sure for me he would be in that mix. But with regard to the records, he's, you know, he always maintains he's just going out to get as many poles and many, he's going for the race win and looking at that weekend. He can get more world championships if he is in the team and if he is in the car that's quick enough. You know, it's because the two go together. If you're in something that's off the pace, you're not going to win a world championship. End of story.
Do you see, you know, people talk a lot about the fact he's got lots of other business interests. Do you see him getting bored and walking away from F1 at any point? Is that possible?
Well, there's going to be a time when, you know, all drivers' careers come to an end, especially at Formula One. And, you know, he could probably keep going until late 30s. I'm not clear how old Lewis is now, 33?
Yeah, 33
like
off the top of my head, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, if he wants to, you've got another 5 years, maybe 6 years. For me, the big thing in this game is that it's, you know, it's great. You need to be talented. You need to be fast. You need to work with a team. But underneath all that, coming back to that word I was using earlier, is passion. You've got to want this with all your heart because Formula One is obsessional. It takes over your entire life. Being a top-level racing driver, it's all you think about normally. It's all you want to do. It's what you're focused on. It's what holds your attention. As long as Lewis has got the drive, and no pun intended on that, but the drive to really want to keep going as fast as possible, then he can keep going for a good amount of time.
Perry, thank you so much for joining us. As always, I love arguing with you about F1. We can do it anytime. Perry McCarthy there, former F1 driver and the original Stig, of course. And I do stand by, and, you know, Perry is a racer, and I think all racers hate being told not to race by officials in races. And that's kind of, to a certain extent, what happened on Sunday, but we have to have rules as well. Anyway, I won't stop arguing with Perry, but it's not fair of me to start putting points across when he's already gone. Perry McCarthy, yeah, the original Stig. Just a quick dip into the transfer page. I've been sifting through the newspapers, trying to pick out the very best transfer rumours. We've got one from The Sun today, which suggests that Manchester United will give David De Gea £20 million if he leaves for PSG now. Remember, David De Gea only has a year left on his current contract at United. There is an expectation now that Gigi Buffon is leaving Paris Saint-Germain that PSG will be one of those clubs looking at signing him. We know Real Madrid are also potentially in that conversation as well if they get rid of Thibaut Courtois. However, they know, or at least De Gea knows, if he runs down his contract, he can go to PSG on a free and say to them, look, I'm saving you a transfer fee here. Do what Juve did for Aaron Ramsey. Give me a lot of money. So now United are trying to cover that off by saying, look, we'll give you the £20 million that PSG will probably give you next summer anyway. We just want to make sure that we get the transfer fee, which is expected, we understand from The Sun, that United are, quote, braced for a bid of between £60 million and £75 million. I love transfer talk, as in the language of transfers in football. And being braced for a bid always makes me think that they go into a board meeting and they batter sort of crooked bits of wood across the windows and they nail the door shut like they're battering down the hatches for a storm. We understand United are braced for a bid and also we can't get into the boardroom because they've nailed the door shut. all right. They're also, we understand, making an outgoing bid. They've had a £40 million bid for Aaron Wan-Bissaka rejected by Crystal Palace. The Eagles want closer to £60 million. I suspect if that's what they want, that's what they're going to get. Because United do really need a right back. We know that they want to sign young players after they got the Daniel James deal done. So I think we're probably going to see United put in a £60 million bid for Aaron Wan-Bissaka. And I can't see Palace turning that down.
Love sport.
Now, I did actually watch the England game yesterday, partly because of my job, but also because I like, you know, when England are playing, I'm going to watch them. It doesn't happen that often, so I'm always going to do it. And it's time for us to do our regular three good, three bad.
Good.
Trent Alexander-Arnold. I can't remember the number of times I've sat here and gone, God, he's good, isn't he? But he really is. 2 years ago, Alexander-Arnold missed the European Under-19 Championships on the request of his club. That was what he did summer 2 years ago. Now, I was expecting, when I looked that up, to find that he had played the Under-19 Championships and won it. They were out in Georgia, remember. But Liverpool knew what a busy season was coming up, and they also realised what they had on their hands. They knew, and frankly, the rest of us probably didn't. It was a game that lacked any sort of intensity yesterday, but one constant was Trent Alexander-Arnold's near-perfect delivery. Even his bad one nearly beat the keeper at and dipped in at the far post.
Bad.
Raheem Sterling, I'm afraid to say. That's the first time you've heard that bad, isn't it, Ben? He really likes that. You should see the little look on his little face, little chuckle. Right, Raheem Sterling was bad. It pains me to say it, because he's had such a great season, you know, as a footballer, as a man. He's been superlative on the pitch. He's been very impressive off it, and I think matured into a true leader. You know, he's only 24 years old. Very easy to forget that he's only 24 years old, but he acts like a 34-year-old, and that's to his credit. He even obviously captained England last week, but frankly, he was really poor yesterday. I might have changed my mind if that free kick with which he hit the bar late on had gone in, but it was asking a lot for that. I think he did well to hit the bar. So I would suggest that he was off the pace. He actually looked tired, you know, missed shots. There was an awful touch on the edge of the box when he was basically played in, just shinned it to the byline. He got caught in two minds a couple of times as well. You know, he's a guy who has generally managed himself in terms of tiredness pretty well. He's occasionally been given stick for it, actually, very unfairly, if you ask me. But he did look tired. Probably not surprising when you consider that he's played more than 50 times for City this season alone.
Good!
Jordan Pickford, eh? You know, another guy who gets a lot of stick, but I thought he wasn't that bad on Thursday when England lost 3-1. You know, nothing he could really do about the goals. A couple of really good saves from Memphis Depay. Even his distribution, although that was poor, he's being asked to do quite a hard skill and without the people in front of him to offer enough options. So I actually think he's not done badly on Thursday. And then on Sunday, you know, he proved that the one thing you can say about him is his confidence is unshakable. Having said that, he did say afterwards, after the shootout, that he was desperately hoping it might be over by number 5, so he didn't have to take it. It also sounded like he didn't really volunteer for that. You know, usually these shootouts, the boss comes in and goes, right, who fancies it? Southgate pretty much said, you're number 5, mate. And Pickford's like, wow, okay. He said he'd been practicing it in training, so why not? What I particularly loved about it, though, was the taking off of the gloves. There's no reason, as a goalkeeper, that you should take your gloves off to take a penalty. Like, there's absolutely zero reason you should do that. But what it did mean is that afterwards, he had to put them back on and made Fabian Schär wait what must have felt like an age to take his penalty. He still scored, but that's the kind of attention to detail that might one day win England a World Cup.
Bad.
Look, some of you don't like VAR, right? One of them sits in the box and complains about it on a daily basis. And I know there are more of you out there. Fine, be that way. But it's coming, so get used to it. Like, it's not going to go away anytime soon. One of those people is Martin Tyler, who was commentating on the game for Sky yesterday. He clearly doesn't like VAR. There were 6 separate occasions yesterday, at least, when he alluded to the fact it was coming in yesterday and made a sort of rubbish joke as though it's all a bit of a farce that it's coming in at all. You know, those sorts of very snide gags that people make when they passive-aggressively don't want something to happen. And every single time you found something to complain about, the pièce de résistance for me in Tyler's gammon-flavoured campaign against progress and change came in the penalty shootout, I thought. What must have been the millionth time, Gary Neville must have had a bruise on his ribs from the number of times Tyler had nudged him, just going, eh? 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 And he said, oh, is that ball on the spot? Oh, maybe VAR will help us decide next year, eh? Eh? Leave it out, Martin. Come on, mate.
Good!
Joe Gomez. Yeah, all right, I appreciate that two of the goods here are Liverpool players, but they both played well, so what do you want me to do? And, you know, that's good news for England fans and Liverpool fans, frankly. Don't forget that Gomez has only played 90 minutes once this year before yesterday. Literally one. Okay, it was against Barcelona in that famous comeback win. But nevertheless, Gomez has barely played since breaking his leg against Burnley. Very few minutes under his belt. Yesterday, he looked unruffled. All right, Switzerland didn't pose much of a threat, but when they did, Gomez was very good. Probably the biggest moment of danger you might not even have noticed, because Alexander Seferovic was just quietly ushered out to the side of the box by Gomez. It was an excellent, excellent piece of defending. And, you know, he was good on the ball, nice and composed on the ball, which is more than can be said for some England defenders this week. So, you know, let's not undervalue that ability. I thought he played really, really well. I hate to wheel out the like a new signing cliche when it comes to players coming back from injury, but that's a little bit what Liverpool are getting next season. They won the Champions League with, you know, without their second best centre half, and on yesterday's showing, he's well and truly back.
Bad.
Now, optimism has not been in short supply in English football over the last 12 months, but this week, I think we can all admit, been a bit of a pinch of salt. Probably one that we should have all taken quite some time ago. It was painfully obvious against the Netherlands on Thursday that we don't have in our ranks a technical midfield. You know, and on Sunday, I actually thought that was even more obvious because Switzerland sat back and said, right, all right, knock the ball around. And honestly, Fabian Delph and Eric Dier, God bless them. They're both decent blokes and hardworking. And I think Delph's all right. And he wins the ball a lot. I think when you're playing as the team and you're going to have less possession, Delph's a really valuable midfielder. But when you're going to have more possession, it's hard to see what he offers. Eric Dier is a centre-half. I think that's really obvious. He does all right in a back three as well. I don't really know what the answer to him is. But neither of those blokes are going to set the world alight. And England needs to start thinking, if they're going to play like this, who are the really technical players who can play in central midfield? Arise, Philip Foden.
Good.
Bad.
Love Sport.
England triumphed yesterday 2-1 in their opening game of the Women's World Cup over in France this summer. Very disappointing for Scotland to go down 14 minutes into a Nikita Paris penalty. Ellen White then made it 2-0 before half-time. Scotland did pull one back just 11 minutes from time. And Phil Neville said that the team didn't think it was going to be hard enough. They thought it was going to be too easy and they didn't concentrate. A lot of work for England to do, it would seem. Let's speak to Anne-Marie Batson, who's on the line, who's going to tell us a little bit more. Anne-Marie, a harsh penalty, do you think?
Oh, goodness me. So, hello, James, by the way.
Nice to speak to you again, Anne-Marie.
And you. Oh, that's such a tough question to answer. No, I don't think it was. I think it was the right call for the referee to make, based on the decisions from the VAR. But it's generated such a debate, hasn't it, about what constitutes a handball, because FIFA issued some new handball rules, from what I understand, and I was reading up on them just to get it clear in my head yesterday and this morning. And I still think it's such a grey area as to what constitutes a handball and what leads to that in terms of a penalty. I think it was a penalty. I think, it, for me personally, if a ball hits you on the shoulder, the arm, the hand, what, no matter if you're, you know, your body's in a unnatural position, whatever that is, it's still a handball for me. But I still think that the rules around it are so unclear that it's creating a lot of confusion.
But the players didn't even appeal for it, and that to me would suggest that, you know, the instinct is it shouldn't have been a penalty.
Yeah, that's true. I was watching it with a group of young women yesterday, and we were talking about that at half time, that nobody seemed to react to it at all. And again, it was because of the video assistant referee alerted the pitch referee at the time. It was odd that none of the players reacted to it. Maybe it's because they didn't actually see it themselves or just were hoping that it would blow over. But that's the thing now with VAR. It is there. It is to point out obvious errors. Whether it was the right decision, I think it's going to split people down the line, because I think some people think that it was the right decision. Others think that it should have been left alone.
Overall, England's performance, Phil Neville was a little bit scathing to a certain extent. I know there was a sort of public dressing down as well. Do you think England needed a... I mean, look, they should have had a wake-up call when they lost New Zealand in the friendly pre-tournament as well. But do you think England need to get out of their blocks a bit quicker now?
I do think England need to get out the blocks a bit quicker. I thought the first half they played pretty well. I think the penalty took the wind out of the sails for Scotland, but it was the second half that I think was quite telling for me. England looked sluggish. And I'm sure you're aware, one or two of the players have said that, you know, people in the media and in the public need to be critical about England's performances and not give a lot of fluff. So I'm actually pleased that Phil Neville has come out and said what he has said. I think they showed some progress, but they also showed some mistakes. I think one or two more of the experienced players allowed themselves to go into an offside position. I know Ellen White did that a couple of times, and she is a player that knows better than that. So I was a bit surprised. In terms of the goal, the Scotland goal, I think Steph Houghton was at fault for that. But again, it was something that, you know, she's an experienced player. I'm sure she's taken that on board. I expected England to really, really attack hard, and I didn't really see a lot of that, for sure. So I was expecting more of a wider goal line. I thought it'd be a 2-1. I was leaning towards more of a 3-1, but I did expect England to push a bit more. And I think the fact that Scotland ran them so close, particularly in the second half, England are going to have to do much better. Their levels of concentration are going to have to be much higher in the second half of a game.
Pretty good moment to play Argentina, probably. We understand they're like to be a pretty weak outfit. England will go out and try and smash them, will they?
I think so, you're right. Argentina are the lowest ranked team in the group. They don't have that rivalry like the senior men's team do. So I would expect England to win that match. That's going to be on Friday in La Havre in Group D. So I expect Phil Neville's going to tinker again. He went out with a 4-3-3 formation for the Scotland team. I suspect we'll see one or two changes, particularly in defence, because I think Millie Bright, she went off with a shoulder injury, so I'm not sure she'll be starting on Friday. But I expect Phil Neville to make a couple of changes, because it is the lowest ranked team in the group, and it'll be good for one or two players to get the opportunity to run out for a World Cup match.
We also know that there are 6.1 million people during its peak watching the England-Scotland game on the BBC on Sunday. What have you made, you know, you're someone who covers women's football on a regular basis, and this is the spotlight time. What have you made of the impact the World Cup has had so far in the mainstream media?
It's a really good question. I think it's had a good impact, but I think it needs more. I think it needs even more. I think, you know, there's been a lot of build-up, particularly to the England and Scotland game, because of the rivalry between the two. So there's been a lot of focus on that. And England are one of the favourites. They're one of three, I would say, for the favourites of the tournament. So there's been a lot of press and commentary and punditry around that. I think what was interesting for me, though, James, was the numbers in the stadium. It's fantastic to see that, you know, the figures have come out from the viewing, as you said, 6.1 million at peak time watching the match, which is fantastic. I think that's up by 2 million from the last tournament, from the Euros, in terms of viewing figures. That's fantastic. The thing, though, for me, though, was the numbers in the stadium, because there was a lot of promotion about the fact that a lot of these games have sold out. But as it turned out yesterday, I was reading figures yesterday that there was meant to be about 16,000 in the stadium, the Stade de Nice, yesterday, but there was only 13,000. So I don't know why FIFA are going down this road of saying, you know, there's only a few tickets available for games here and there, or games are sold out, because when you're watching them, you can still see seats available. So I think that's the bigger issue for me. I think it's been fantastic in terms of the coverage, and I think that will keep going. Let's hope it keeps going after the World Cup, of course, when the domestic season starts again. But there are empty seats in the stadiums for the matches, and I'd be keen to understand how FIFA are managing that, but also what are they doing to encourage more people to come out and see the matches live.
I don't know whether you were confident in England's World Cup chances before the tournament started. I can't imagine you're any more confident now. How are you feeling about their chance of winning the whole tournament?
It's so wide open. It's like the women's tennis at the moment. It's so wide open. You can name about three or four teams that have the potential to lift the cup at the end of the World Cup. I think England are definitely in the mix, but I wouldn't write off the USA. They are the current holders. You have Japan as well. They ended up a semi-finalist at the 2015 World Cup. England, of course, they're in for a good shout. So they're the three that I'm looking at. But I think everybody's eyes were opened after the France result when they played South Korea on Friday as part of their opening match. It's the hosts. They're going to have a lot of support. I think the fact that they scored so many goals as well in that opening game, they're surely favourites as well. I think England can do well, but anything less than reaching the final will be a major disappointment, I think, for Phil Neville and his team.
Anne-Marie, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. That's Anne-Marie Batson, their sports broadcaster, someone who knows the women's game inside out. England, of course, just edging past Scotland in the opening game of their World Cup. Win's a win, some people might say. Phil Neville, quite different. He didn't think the second half performance was what they needed to do. They need to be relentless, he said. The Heat also playing a role. The Heat definitely played a role yesterday in England's victory over Switzerland in the Nations League. Ben texted me this morning and goes, oh, what's the point in this Nations League? You know what? It's been good, Ben. I think the one thing they will learn from it is that the finals are a bit removed from the group stages. You know, there was a lot of hype and a lot of excitement and enjoyment around the group stages, especially from England fans, obviously, to beat Spain, that great last-minute winner against Croatia. But there was a lot of good press going with the tournament, which kind of fizzled out with the break between the group stages and the finals. So if there's any changes for next time round, that would be my main thing. But overall, how many poor England games have we had this year? Very few, Ben, and that's to be celebrated.
Love sport.
I think Nadal should start giving some lessons to Unai Emery, because Nadal has mastered the language and Emery has not. Rafa Nadal, quite apart from his excellent English, he picked up his 12th French Open title on Sunday. A remarkable record for a remarkable tennis player. He was made to work for it, at least in the first couple of sets. Dominic Thiem did win the second set, but then was beaten 6-1, 6-1 in the third and the fourth to hand Nadal his 18th Grand Slam title. Closes the gap to Federer to just two. He, of course, has 20. Let's speak to someone who knows all about this match yesterday and can tell us a little bit more. Nathan Salt, online reporter for Mail Sport. Nathan, a remarkable achievement from Rafa Nadal, I think you'll agree. How does this performance rate against some of his other French Open victories?
I mean, it really was a much more of a battle than it was the year before when he played Thiem. And I feel like when I was watching it, it was among some of the best tennis we've seen from Nadal, because he was against a competitor that is so close now to sort of dethroning him. And he had to be his imperious best, particularly in that third set, I thought, and then he sort of ran away with it. But yeah, right up there, I think. And like, as you said, he's getting so close to Federer now. I think that will keep him going in Paris for another couple of years.
I mean, watching Nadal through the tournament, I'm sure you will have seen him a couple of times when you were out in Roland Garros. It doesn't feel like he's diminishing his performances at all. You know, we've seen Federer evolve and change, but this just feels like Nadal being the same Nadal and, if anything, playing better.
He just has so much confidence at that tournament, though. I think that's what it is. He just feels so relaxed and comfortable. And it will be interesting to see, you know, next year if they have a roof and all the sort of circumstances change. Because there's a lot of talk about the redevelopment of Chatre, how he would feel. But yeah, he just feels so comfortable there that he just doesn't feel like he's going to lose a set, never mind a match. So yeah, he seems to be getting better with age, like a fine wine, Nadal in Paris, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the match against Federer was straight sets. I mean, he swept him aside, but there was some very high quality tennis there. I heard a lot of chants for Federer, which probably says as much about his relationship with fans all over the world as does for Nadal. At what point, you know, if Federer does quit, will it be for Nadal get to 21 and then go?
I would think so. I don't think he'll go if he gets, you know, if he levels it, he may as well keep going. Federer, I think this year, I mean, he won't do the French again next year, you wouldn't think, due to the Olympics. So Federer maybe has until next Wimbledon maybe, and then he might call it a day at the Olympics. That's what I would imagine. So for Nadal, the target has to be 21. I personally can't see him winning on another surface, so I think he's just got to keep himself fit and ready to go in Paris for the next couple of years.
You mentioned Wimbledon there, and we're looking forward to that, of course. Nadal traditionally does, as you say, kind of ruin himself on the clay and come to Wimbledon with one leg, but he seems, touch wood, to be a little bit more injury-free at the moment.
He does, and I think it was interesting, you know, when he played last year at Wimbledon against Djokovic, there was a kind of big sort of uproar about the conditions and the roof being closed and all that kind of thing. So, you know, you can't really rule Nadal out. It'd be foolish to rule Nadal out of Wimbledon having just won the French Open, but you would feel like maybe Djokovic, you know, wants to sort of make amends for going out against Dominic Thiem. I think he was really disappointed in that. And, you know, let's not forget that he'd won all the other Grand Slams in the calendar year before the French. So it will be interesting to see how much it's taken out of Nadal on the clay. His knee, you know, as you say, is not usually very good on grass, but fingers crossed. It would be good for Nadal, I think, if he can get even a step closer to Federer, that really would make it interesting in the debate of, you know, who is the best of all time. I think that'd be great.
And you mentioned Federer, you know, we are almost sort of moving on to his area of the season now, but part of the reason he played Roland Garros this year, where he hasn't played for a while, is so that he wouldn't come to Wimbledon ring rusty, if to borrow a boxing phrase. He felt that he hadn't played enough tennis. Do you think that he has hit his stride now and he will come to Wimbledon bang in form?
Yeah, I thought he was really impressive, actually. More impressive than I expected him to be on the clay, given, you know, he last won the event in 2009 and he hadn't played for 3 or 4 years. So I think it actually will benefit him going into the grass court season. And he actually said that clay is really good preparation for the grass, which threw quite a few people off. But I think he is right. You know, he just needs to keep playing games and matches, because it just, yeah, it stops him from sort of getting a bit tight and, yeah, a bit rusty, as you say, ring rusty. So I think it's a wise move on his part, and he will be really confident that he can go to Wimbledon, where he's had such a dominance there, and add to those 20 Grand Slams.
Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, all playing pretty well. Who do you think is the favourite for Wimbledon, and who do you think will win? Is it the favourite?
I'm a big fan of Federer. I'd love to see Federer add to his titles, but I would have to say Djokovic. You know, he's so good. I mean, he is probably the best returner in the game for me. And just the way it panned out against Thiem, I think Thiem is obviously great on clay, but I think on other surfaces, Djokovic is such an all-rounder. And I keep thinking about the Australian Open final against Nadal, where he was so dominant. And you'd probably say clay is his weakest surface, and he got to the semi-finals and only just went out there with all the conditions. So I would have to say Djokovic is my favourite, but it'd be great for Federer if he can add another one.
Nathan, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure. Nathan Salt there, online reporter at Mail Online. In the sports section, spent a lot of time out at Roland Garros. Lucky him. Avoiding the wind and the rain, no doubt, as well.
Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. And it's my first chance to talk to you about Eden Hazard since he left Chelsea over the weekend, of course. He was one of the big stories, and it looks like they're going to lose Sarri as well. He and Hazard could be unveiled by their new clubs over the weekend. It could be Thursday, in fact. They might be announced on the same day. But I'm slightly disappointed, because it makes this week in the Premier League a weaker league. Eden Hazard, he's gone for £88 million. Which could rise to more than 150, by the way, if Hazard goes on to win almost everything at Real Madrid. Frankly, who would bet against him? Because for all the paucity with which Real Madrid have played this year, Hazard is a man who can transform a team. That's the ability that he has. And there aren't many players like that. As Miguel Delaney points out in his effort to sort of sum up Hazard's legacy to the Premier League, he said Hazard was the key and the most influentially decisive player in two different title-winning teams. Arguably, only Eric Cantona, Cristiano Ronaldo, Thierry Henry and Roy Keane can make similar claims. I think Miguel's pretty spot on there, because Hazard is a difficult man to argue with in terms of how well he played and how good he's been. And also, he's both transformed teams and adapted with them. To win the title two different occasions with two very different teams and very different managers, he's right up there in terms of Premier League all-time players. 85 goals, 110 in all competitions for Chelsea. And also the way he did it. Because the way he did it, when you think of those players, right? Cantona, Ronaldo, Henry and Keane. I think he is distinctively different from all four of those players. I was reminded of a quote from Ronaldinho today. He said, "Football is about joy. It's about dribbling. I favour every idea that makes the game beautiful." Hazard makes the game beautiful. He has that low centre of gravity, that glue-like control of the ball when he's dribbling with it, and that sort of instant speed that makes him, I think, really mesmeric to watch. Like, even as a Liverpool fan, right? I don't want to see Chelsea do well necessarily, but I always enjoy watching Eden Hazard. Even that goal in the League Cup, which I didn't like, obviously, because he scored against us. But even that goal, I look at it and think, that is amazing. That is what football's about. And dribbling has this sort of amazing effect on us. Because, yes, it's great watching a good passer of the ball. Yes, it's great watching someone who can strike a shot from 30 yards. But dribbling is what we all do all the time. as kids in the playground. It's what football is based on, isn't it? It's the most amazing skill. I think it's the one that, you know, if you are a great footballer playing in a rubbish team, the only thing you can do is dribble and then shoot. It's what you have to do. It is the, at its very purest, it is football. Dribbling with the ball. And that's what I love about watching Eden Hazard. And I'm sad that I'm now not going to get to watch him on a week in, week out basis in the Premier League. Sure, I can watch La Liga and fine, but, you know, he's not here anymore. He's gone. But there's a flip side to Hazard as well. And I don't mean this to criticise. I don't want to criticise him. But he is perhaps just of a certain type, a type of player. He is, I always think about him like Diego Maradona. Because Maradona, similarly, would dribble and dribble and dribble. And that was his best skill. Maradona, similarly, was meted with what I always think is the compliment of having players kick him from pillar to post throughout his career. And also, he's such a single-minded person. And that, for a lot of these players, is how they become successful. A tunnel vision, a single-mindedness, a drive to succeed. But it also creates problems in a team sport. I don't think player power is a modern phenomenon per se. I just think that we see it a bit more and we hear about it a bit more now than we used to. And Hazard has, by so many managers, been criticised for failing to capitalise on all the talent that he has. They've said he doesn't work hard enough, that he should be scoring 40 goals a season, not 20 goals a season or 25 goals a season, for not having a killer instinct, for not working hard enough in training. He doesn't work hard in training because it's not hard for him. It's easy. Sarri said that. He said training sessions are easy for Eden Hazard. That's how good he is. You can't work hard in training if there's nothing to make you work hard. It's why you bump a kid up at school who's really bright, or you make the 13-year-old Joe Cole play in the under-17s to push them forward. You can't do that with Eden Hazard. At Chelsea, he had reached his peak. So realistically, the only thing he could do would be go to Real Madrid. That is what will push him, being with even better players. But he doesn't. Does he have that killer instinct? I don't know. Maybe he has that Ronaldinho instinct, where joy matters, glory. I think Socrates, the footballer, not the philosopher, said there is success, but there is also glory. And he loves that. He likes the joy of football. And managers, I think, have always wanted to be part of that. You know, you look at the managers come in and say, I want you to do this, I want you to do this. Sarri wanted to turn him into a 40-goal-a-season striker. Antonio Conte wanted him to score more goals from the inside left channel. And they were always frustrated. And Hazard himself said, I didn't just frustrate Conte. In my career, I have frustrated all of my trainers. Now here I am frustrating Sarri. They think I need to mark more, do more here, more than I am doing. And the next coach I have, I will also frustrate him. So Hazard has this thing where he says, I know what I can do best. And just because you look at it from the outside and think I could do other things better. Now, I don't always admire that. I think you have to try and allow as many different opinions into your thought process as possible in order to find the best one. As much information as possible to find the best solution. But what's going to be fascinating now is Eden Hazard, one of the best footballers on the planet, is A, going to go up against one of the other ones, Lionel Messi. It's going to be a direct competition. The Messi-Ronaldo rivalry is dead. It's Messi-Hazard now. That's going to be great. But what's also going to happen is he's going to walk into a room, and maybe for the first time in his career, he's going to look at the manager and think, this guy can teach me something. Zinedine Zidane, a genius of a player and now a successful manager, was Hazard's boyhood hero. It's half the reason he's gone this summer, I'm sure of that. How his time at Real Madrid evolves will be shaped by that relationship with Zinedine Zidane. Will Hazard finally listen to a manager? Will Zizou be the man to tell him how to play, how to improve his game? Or will he frustrate him, like Hazard has all the other managers? I don't know the answer, but I think it's going to be fascinating finding out.
Love Sport.
Now, I watch sport very closely over the weekend. Maybe as closely as you, maybe less so, I don't know. But it's time for our regular little things you might have missed. Arsene, what was your favourite bit of the game last night?
I didn't see it.
But you must have seen some funny moments in the game.
I didn't see it.
All right, what about that new Zac Efron film?
I didn't see it.
Well, at least I was watching, Arsene. Yes, I was. And if you were watching the Canadian Grand Prix, you'll have noticed Sebastian Vettel's reaction to losing it. Many people called it childish, a hissy fit, a tantrum. I would probably agree, frankly. But it did make me laugh when afterwards, having whinged on the radio for the last 10 laps, he parked his car in the podium enclave and subsequently removed the large number one marker from in front of Hamilton's car. Childish, yes, but it made for great TV.
I didn't see it.
Now, in the Cricket World Cup, India's form has been ominously good, so far at least. It's perhaps unsurprising because the ICC did give them an entire week off in preparation for the tournament that no one else got, by the way. They didn't have to start until a week in. Very kind of them indeed, but it seems to have worked. They racked up 352 for 5 against Australia and South London on Sunday. There was 100 for Shikhar Dhawan, 82 from Virat Kohli, and there was a 14-ball cameo from that man, Mahendra Singh Dhoni, MS Dhoni. He made 27 in those 14 balls, including a remarkable swatted 6 over mid-wicket. the amazing replay from the other side saw Virat Kohli make a face that basically said, "Phew," and then a little chuckle. Remarkable.
I didn't see it.
Now, Kevin Magnussen did not have a great weekend at the Canadian Grand Prix. He had to start from the pit lane right at the back of the field because he crashed during qualifying. He had to change his gearbox. The Haas driver then basically ended up pootling around the track at the back. He was sandwiched between the two Williams drivers by the end, which is a bit like being between two shopping trolleys because they are not fast cars. He was quick to complain on team radio about what he called the worst experience of his racing career. Principal Gunther Steiner got on the radio and replied, "The guys have stayed up all night to fix the car. Enough is enough. Maybe, Kevin, if you hadn't binned it in the wall, the car wouldn't be in such a terrible state."
I didn't see it.
And finally, the bails didn't come off. What am I talking about? Well, if you were watching the India-Australia game, you will have seen Jasprit Bumrah's first ball to David Warner, who only had 5 at the time, sort of stabbed down on it and it hit the stumps. Oh, he's got him. But no, the bails didn't come off. Now, there's a lot of talk about whether these bails are too heavy, whether they're too difficult to dislodge from the actual grooves they sit in. What, maybe it's the new electronic ones, they light up when they go off. I don't know what the answer is, but there are a lot of commentators getting very excited about the fact the bails won't come off anymore. I think they should all grow up a bit. Bails are bails. He seemed to think that they weren't a requirement for the modern game anymore. It's fine. It's just fine.
Honestly, during the game, I didn't see it. Love
sport. It's also worth noting at news that I'm sure you will have heard over the weekend, but nevertheless worth mentioning is the sad passing of Justin Edinburgh, the Leighton Orient manager. We heard in the middle of last week that he'd suffered a heart attack, and that alone was a pretty serious shock. You know, the guy was only 49. He was in good health as far as we knew, and we knew that he hadn't gone well. He had suffered a cardiac arrest and very sadly passed on Saturday. We, of course, our thoughts are with his family, with Leighton Orient, the football club as well. It was shocking news, and the tributes have, as you can understand, flown in from all across the football community. Mickey Hazard, a friend of the station, of course, and a Tottenham legend, said, "No words. Today we lost an amazing human being and one of life's great, great guys, Justin Edinburgh. My thoughts and prayers are with your family and friends on this incredibly sad day. Rest in peace, my friend. Go play some footy in the sky." David Ginola as well said, "Deeply shocked, deeply saddened. RIP, my friend. One death too many from cardiovascular disease, a silent global epidemic." And maybe something more in that. And also Gary Lineker, of course, another former teammate of Justin Edinburgh, who said he was deeply saddened to hear that he had passed away. "He was an excellent coach and a terrific fullback who was a delight to share a dressing room and have as a teammate. Thoughts are with his family. Hashtag RIP Justin." And Graham Butler too, a former Leighton Orient player and a host that loves sport. He was speaking yesterday after the news and admitted it was obviously incredibly hard to take.
"It's just really hard to get your head around it. You know, he's 49 years old. He's the season that they had last year, the euphoria around everything, that everything should just be geared towards League Two next year. You know, you really just don't you don't plan for something like this. It's hard to deal with because it wasn't an ongoing illness. There wasn't any foresight to say, you know, something. He's not been feeling well lately.
we was with him in Madrid last week. You know, he was literally standing in front of me when I was out there with Spurs and family and stuff like that. And he's singing up there, dancing. He looks genuinely fit and healthy. My brother-in-law spoke to him just outside the ground just before he went in. Had a good chat with him. He seemed happy, jovial, you know, in really, really good spirits. He was a Tottenham ambassador. He'd done a lot for the Legends. He was actually supposed to be playing in a Spurs Legends game this afternoon. So everything was just as normal. It's just an off-season for him, really.
Yeah, I think you can hear in Graham's voice there, they're just the shock. And even today, I think we're all sort of slightly struggling to come to terms with exactly what has happened because, as Graham says, he was in such good nick. He wasn't someone we knew had been ill or anything like that. And, you know, always difficult in the football community. You know, I met Justin Edinburgh once, years ago, interviewed him when he was up playing against Barnet. And, you know, he seemed like a good guy, a football manager after a difficult 0-0 at Barnet. I mean, you know, there's plenty of those. But I had no real relationship with the man. And nevertheless, when the notification hit my phone on Saturday, it was a real sort of gut-wrencher. You know, you never want to hear of anyone dying, but someone who, through sport or through football, you feel you've got some connection with. And maybe it's because the Leighton Orient story was so strong this year as well. What Justin achieved with them. You know, I was reading pieces this morning about how he made the club believe again. You know, because of that, we almost felt like we had a relationship with the man, even though I didn't. And he was a terrific manager as well, and I know Leighton Orient captain Joby Mackenough has already spoken and laid a team shirt in sort of tribute to him and of how well he's done. Why don't we have a little listen? Because, look, you never want anyone's life to end early, but you can't say it didn't end on a high note for Justin. His beloved Spurs getting to the Champions League final and taking Leighton Orient back into the Football League. I'm sure you've seen this video before, but I want you to hear it again. It's Justin speaking just after winning the National League with Orient. I think it says a lot about how great a man he is.
I just say that it's been an honour to lead this group, players, staff, and the board of directors, and everyone connected with the football club. Okay, because for me, when I come in here, this club was going one way, and that was into the Conference South. Okay, so credit to you because there's not been a lot of change. Remember, enjoy tonight and tomorrow and Monday and Tuesday. And when we get at that airport.
I think that's how we should remember Justin, really. And that's kind of what I wanted to say here on the James Gray Show is that this is a guy who lived and breathed football. He played professional football for 20 odd years. He was a football manager for 16 years. Look, that kind of thing, you don't become a football manager because you're broke or because you feel you should or because the opportunity was there. You become a football manager, one of the hardest jobs, one of the most exhausting jobs, because you love the game. And that seems to me to be one of the overarching things that just people really found was attractive about Justin, why people sort of were drawn to him and why players believed in him. Great football managers are always those who players can really get behind because they believe in the same thing. Great footballers are those who play the game because they love it. And someone like Justin, from everything that you've read, from the brief time I met him, he's someone who really loved and believed in football. And that is something that doesn't go away. Terribly sad that he's lost his life at the age of 49, but at least there are plenty of strong and positive memories of Justin Edinburgh.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.